Otherwise, grass is cut.
No, so I mean, it looks
Just,
really good. That's what I'm saying. Like,
yeah.
but
I
you
just gotta
don't have
wait
to.
3 days. Well, it's 30 minutes per battery to recharge.
How many did you use? I thought it came with two.
I've used every battery in this house.
You're joking.
I'm about to hook up the car battery
No, no,
now.
no,
Group, no.
what?
No,
Absolutely. Yeah.
yeah, it's
Yeah.
called
I
grass.
know.
Yeah,
Okay. Love you.
you too. See you later.
Bye. She says bye. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. I'm Blair.
And I'm Kirsten, and we are
Mediocre
Content. And while we may be coming off of a lower week, generally, I feel like today is going to be fine.
I just did that whole intro without looking at it, which sounds like it's not a big deal, but I usually have to look at it to remember what to say.
We start the same way every time.
I know. I know.
I mean, in fairness, you say a lot more than I do in the intro. You say hello, everyone, and
Right.
welcome to the show.
Well, and then, like, that's not really my normal way of greeting someone, obviously. So, like,
Hello.
sometimes my first inclination is to be like,
Sure.
Hi, what's up?
Yo. No, and now what we should do is when we engage with strangers, we should say hello and welcome to the show.
Oh.
Because I do feel like every interaction with me could be a show. At least a sitcom. I don't know. Rom-com?
Girl, I don't know.
I mean,
not
it's kind of.
rom-com. I feel
It's,
like you and Tyler are pretty, like, stable and boring.
I mean, oh, well, I at least thought I was funny.
And, like, well, you are funny. But it could be, I would say, more of a sitcom.
Oh, okay. All right.
That's
fine.
All I'm saying.
I'll take the sitcom. Either
Not to
way,
be.
I'm not going to say that to people. You're like, ah, welcome to the show. Can you imagine?
Can you imagine?
Anyway, well,
that's what I'm saying. Rom-com, saying that to a by a, and like meaning a rom-com is a little bit interesting, different.
Well, now I feel like I need a dance to go with it. You know, a
okay.
catchy song, maybe a dance, a tap dance, perhaps specifically.
Perhaps. So you're just always going to be wearing tap shoes? Is that what I'm hearing?
I feel like I just need to have them ready. You know,
I
just like whip them out.
Uh-huh.
I wonder if they have slide-on tap shoes.
I'm
so
sure
helpful.
Someone has done that. They've probably strapped a pair of like the little tappy things to the pair of Vans or something.
Oh, that's, or they've got those new stretchy laces, which I desperately want. Have you seen
Ooh, yeah.
those?
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
I've seen those.
I forget who puts them out, but I've seen so many people and they just slip right on. And I'm like, that's freaking great. Cause I hate
It
tying
sounds
my shoes.
Really nice. Yeah.
Also, when I have nails, I can't hardly tie my shoes. So it's an individual problem, but it is frustrating.
Yes. That's
okay?
all I got for me today. It's Monday and it's
yes.
early for me.
It is.
Ish.
Yeah.
Sorry, my brain is loading as per usual.
All swell. We could disclaim if you want, and because you're doing the good
yeah.
news anyway. So
you're right. You're right. Let
yeah.
me get this show on the road.
Literally.
All right. So our disclaimer is the same as always. We are not experts on anything. Please, if you've come to the podcast to get any kind of advice, do not do that. Jinx.
I think it's a mouthful of cat butt.
But we are the place to learn about things that may not have already crossed your algorithm. So please give us a listen. Stick with us until the end. You can do it. And let us know if we say something that's like not 100% true. We do our best here. The research team does their best at Mediocre Content. Okay.
That's very true.
And with that, I am now doing the good news. So I'm just going to throw that right over to myself.
Catch it.
So this one is about solar energy. The state of New York recently met its goal of installing 6 gigawatts of solar power 1 year ahead of schedule. Isn't that amazing for them?
It is amazing.
Outlined in the 2019 Clean Energy and Climate Change Law, a state agency said that the accomplishment in advance of the 2025 deadline underscores the state's position as one of the strongest distributed solar markets in the nation.
Hmm.
The term refers to the quality or the quantity of solar power contributions to energy demand that come from panels owned by both individual homes and businesses and larger solar farms. The announcement was made by the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority at the opening of a recent solar array in New Scotland managed by New Leaf Energy that will power nearly 1,000 homes.
Jeez.
Quote, today we celebrate the early achievement of New York's 6 GW gigawatt milepost, which brings us one step closer to a reliable and resilient zero emission grid, Governor Kathy Hochul says.
Nice.
Quote, distributed solar is the heart of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, expanding the availability of renewable energy, and delivering substantial benefits for our health, our environment, and our economy, end quote. The New York State Energy Research and Development Authority claims that solar projects in New York have created more than 14,000 solar jobs statewide in a variety of roles. It also stated that in 2023 alone, 885 megawatts worth of solar projects were installed, raising the amount, the total amount of private equity invested into the state's solar energy market to $9.2 billion.
That's insane, actually.
In anticipation of the success, 3 years ago, Governor Hochul directed the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority. That's a long acronym.
It is.
And the Department of Public Service to expand the global to expand the goal to 10 gigawatts by 2030. 3.4 gigawatts of new installations are already in development. The state's far neighbor, Maine, also recently accomplished an energy transition goal ahead of schedule with a 100,000 heat pumps installed 2 years in advance of their original 2025 target. Maine Governor Janet Mills, like Hochul now, also unveiled a new target after achieving the first, installing another 175,000 additional heat pumps in Maine by 2027.
That's really not that far away.
No, they're doing great work in the Northeast.
They are doing great work. Surprising that it's in the Northeast, but I'm not mad at it. That's for sure. Ah, the cat has joined us. Jinx, would you like to say something for the podcast? I guess not.
He's meowing. You just can't hear him.
Rude.
I know. So the thing with Jinx is he's literally like over here off camera, yes, like rubbing up against my hand, acting as if he's never, ever seen me. And we've just reunited after a long voyage apart or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then I pick him up and he's like, this is disgusting.
Don't touch. Unhand me, woman.
That's right.
That's just so anyway, cats, man.
Salem's not like that, though.
Oh, really?
Salem, literally, because ever since he was a kitten, he'll stand at my feet, look up at me, meow, like whine, meow, and then demand to be lifted up onto my shoulder like a baby. Mm. So anyway.
As one should.
I don't know, man. All right, so this next one has to do with type 2 diabetes. So if you have that, please listen up. People with type 2 diabetes who stick to a low-carb diet may be able to stop taking medication, suggests a new study. This is very exciting.
This is.
American researchers found low-carbohydrate diets may improve the beta cell function in patients being treated for the condition, which affects around 34 million Americans and 1 in 15 people worldwide. Type 2 diabetes most often develops in people aged 45 or older, but more and more children, teens, and young adults are also developing the disease. The researchers explained that beta cells are endocrine cells in the pancreas that produce and release insulin, the hormone that controls blood sugar levels. People with this disease have compromised beta cell response to blood sugar, which is insulin resistance, possibly due to in part to eating too many carbs. Empty carbs are full of sugar, white flour, and white flour, which have a high glycemic index, which means they cause the blood sugar and insulin levels to spike rapidly after eating. They include refined grains that have been stripped of bran fiber and nutrients, such as white bread or bagels, pizza dough, chips, pasta, pastries, white rice, sweet desserts, and many breakfast cereals. So if anything you've ever enjoyed,
falls
That's
in
pretty
that
much it.
category.
Quote, this study shows people with type 2 diabetes on a low carbohydrate diet can recover their beta cells, an outcome that cannot be achieved with medication, said study lead author Professor Barbara Gower of the University of Alabama. Quote, people with mild type 2 diabetes who reduce their carbohydrate intake may be able to discontinue medication and enjoy eating meals and snacks that are higher in protein and meet their energy needs. For the study published online by the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism, the research team gathered data from 57 adults with type 2 diabetes, half on a low carb diet and the other half on a high carb diet, and examined their beta cell function and insulin secretion at the outset and after 12 weeks. All of the participants' meals were provided. People on the carb-restricted diet ate 9% carbohydrates and 65% fat, while those on a high-carb diet ate 55% carbohydrates and 20% fat. The team found that those on a low-carb compared to a high-carb diet saw improvements in the acute and maximal beta cell responses that were twofold and 22% greater, respectively.
Nice.
Black participants on a low carb diet saw 110% greater improvement in the acute beta cell response, while white adults had improvements in the maximal beta cell response that were 48% greater than their respective counterparts on the high carb diet. Professor Gower said further research is needed to confirm that a low carbohydrate diet can restore beta cell function and lead to remission in people with type 2 diabetes.
That's
So
great.
you may be asking yourself, Blair, I thought we already knew this. I thought we knew that like diabetics can't have carbs. The
Sure.
answer to that is, of course we did, obviously. But like this shows that you can recover your insulin resistance,
Correct.
which is really significant, which means it can be totally reversed, which is great.
Yes. It's not
And
so
we didn't
much.
have that research before, so.
Right. And now we do. And people can start feeling better, which is great.
Yeah. Love
Lovely.
that for us.
Well, that is fantastic and not spooky. So now I'm going to give us stuff that's spooky.
Great.
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 So we are continuing our cryptid series this week, which is also good news, I would say, because
Oh,
this week. Yes, go ahead.
I guess we should say happy Halloween
Oh,
because it is
yeah.
on Thursday.
That's true. Yeah. Happy Halloween.
Happy
Enjoy.
Halloween.
Please be safe if you're a trick-or-treater or
Yes.
if you're going to Halloween parties, be mindful, be careful.
Mindful, demure.
Also, feel free to send us photos of your costumes if they're appropriate. That would be kind
Yes,
of cool.
I would love that.
Yeah,
Yep.
feel free.
I've seen some really good ones on
They're
TikTok. They're
really great this
so
year.
good. And I love my favorite TikToks are like the ones where it's like the audio from Mean Girls, where it's like, in girl world, Halloween is the one time of year where girls can wear sexy costumes and get away with it, or something like that.
Yeah.
Or lingerie, I don't know, whatever. Anyway, but I love that. And then the costume is absolutely not sexy
Not
in any
sexy at
way.
all. Yeah,
It's the
like
best thing ever.
the one I recently saw of that was the SpongeBob girl that's just like, I hate chocolate.
I saw that one too yesterday. Oh my God, it was so
It
good.
is so good.
She's got like a wheelchair and like everything's
Yeah.
painted. And then she just sticks her head in that's like painted brown to match the lady. And
She did a really good job.
chocolate. Oh my God, that was the best.
Oh.
I was just thinking of that. And I was going to send it to you if you hadn't seen it. So I'm glad you have.
Kelsey, please. Well, yeah, please send us costumes. I'm not dressing up. We might hand out candy if we have stuff left
Yeah.
over. We've done two trunk or treats, so
Nice.
we don't have a ton left over, and I'm
You
not buying more, but
you've distributed appropriate amounts of candy to your community.
we really have. Like, I
Yeah.
think this past weekend we had like the gym. Our gym is right next to like a cheer company
Oh
or
yeah.
whatever, and they hosted along with us the trunk or treat this weekend. We had over 800 kids come through because it was like open to the
Wow.
public, and that
Yeah.
was insane. Anyway.
That's crazy. I plan on putting on a witch hat and sitting on my front porch
Very
with
cute,
a
actually.
huge Costco-sized bucket of candy.
There you go.
So that's the plan. I feel as this year, I just feel like I couldn't get it together enough to like have a costume. Last year, I was Barbie.
Bro, it's already no freaking
Yeah,
November.
I know. I know.
Gross.
And so next year I'm manifesting a Halloween party that I get to host for myself.
That would be
And
fun.
people that we like. So
And not people we don't like.
that's right.
I love that. That would be real lots of fun. We enjoyed
Yeah.
also having Halloween parties. We don't know anybody yet, so kind of
Right.
like,
So that's the problem, right? I just have lack of people. But next year might be different. So we're
yeah,
manifesting it. Yeah.
absolutely. So send us those. If you have parties, send us your decorations. That'd be kind of fun. Inspo, whatever. We'll build a Pinterest board. Anyway, similar to last time with our Nessie series, we're going to start with some stories first. Then we'll talk about the actual cryptid. And we have
My
some fun stuff at the end. What?
brain was like,
Oh, we're not in Twilight.
okay, but you said creepy and fog
I
and
did. Well, unlike Forks, Washington, this is actually on the other side of the world.
okay.
This is on the East Coast of Massachusetts
Fine.
of the United States. Edward is not there. But you know who is there? Some dude named Bill Bartlett, who's going to be our first introduction to our cryptid this week. So at the time, Bill was 17 years old and he was driving with his friends down what is known as Farm Street in Dover, Massachusetts. And this happened on April 21st, 1977. So not all that long ago. It was about 10:30 p.m. when the friends spotted a strange creature in their headlights. At first, they could see the figure kind of sitting on the stone wall that's kind of lining the road, almost kind of like it was an animal, especially because when they were driving up to it, their headlights actually caused their eyes to flash and glow from the high beams. As the car got closer to the creature, though, the group noticed that it actually had hand-like structures clinging to the rocks as they zoomed past. And then they decided to have a panic attack and were
Oh,
extremely
God.
confused about what they saw. But by the time Bill returns home, he decides, I'm gonna draw this thing. I'm gonna sketch out exactly what I saw. And it turned out to be one of the most famous images of what we're talking about today, the Dover Demon. And I've provided
Wow.
a photo of the drawing for Blair to see.
It looks like, let me see if I can describe this accurately. It looks like, an alien from War of the Worlds, as well as the demon thing from Stranger Things that is called a Demogorgon.
There you go.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
It looks like that.
All right. So, to provide a little bit more description of what Bill actually interviewed about, apparently after this came out and he drew the picture and more people were coming forward, Bill and his friends were also coming forward with their descriptions of what they saw. And he specifically said that the creature appeared to be walking on all fours, had strange little feet and hands with long digits. It had two large, round, glowing, glassy, lidless eyes, which is such a description, that shone very bright, specifically orange. The head was shaped kind of like a marble and was the same size as the rest of the body, which is horrifying. And then it was also peach colored, described as shark skin or sandpaper like skin, which is gross. That night, Bill was not the only person who would actually come face to face with this creature, and that is why it's such a weird cryptid, because that exact night, someone else had a similar sighting, and their name was John Baxter. So keep in mind that Bill and his friends were driving down that road at about 10:30 at night. John, on that same exact night, it's now midnight. He's 15. He was walking home on the south end of Miller Hill Road. And as he walked down the dark road, he noticed a shadowy figure walking on two legs towards him with an oddly shaped head. I would crap my pants. Just gonna be very honest.
Yeah, the two-leg thing is weird.
Yeah, especially after the first count was just like, yeah, it was on all fours. According to John, he had a friend, MJ, that had a seemingly larger head to body ratio, and he thought that that was MJ coming down the road. So he actually began calling out for him. And as he got closer to the figure, and getting no reply, they came about 15 feet apart from each other. John called out one last time before the figure darted off into a nearby gully, up a small slope, and then leaned against a nearby tree with a spindly finger clutching the trunk and eyes glowing in the dark.
Okay.
I would shit myself a second time. Just gonna be very honest.
Yeah.
That's so scary. That night, John also drew a picture that would be almost identical to the one that Bill did, even though they'd never crossed paths. They didn't discuss the creature sightings together. Like, there was no connection to these two people that had almost identical accounts on the same night. It's crazy. But it gets worse. Because the final piece, the final story, happens literally 24 hours later. There is a girl, Abby Brabham, on the night of now April 22nd, 1977. She's also 15. She and her boyfriend were driving down Springdale Avenue, so it is a different street. And as they jostled down the street, Abby looked up to see something crouched again on all fours. But this time it was actually in the middle of the road and in the headlights, of course, because you're driving down the road.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And at first, Abby thought it might be a monkey, apparently, which honestly, I could see. I don't know how often you find monkeys in Massachusetts, though. Someone can enlighten me.
Well, when your brain's trying to rationalize what you're seeing.
Sure. You know? Especially considering how it was walking, because keep in mind, it's on all fours. It's got like kind of human like fingers. So that would make sense. It was walking across the street. However, she did describe it being completely hairless, a light tan color, but had no apparent nose, ears, or tail features. And the only distinct feature Abby and her boyfriend could actually point out at the time was also its large rounded head, the weird spindly fingers, and of course, its glowing eyes. Now, those are all the sightings that are mainstream information for the most part. Some people claim that it was a foal or a moose calf. I don't know if I buy that. It could be, I guess.
I was going to say, what if it was like freshly born with like all these gross stuff on it?
I mean, sure. But like moose and foal have hooves.
You're right.
You know,
right.
So it's kind of a weird, I would believe the monkey more than the moose calf.
Do you know what if, that would be it. Yeah, I agree. It kind of looks like if E.T. had like a taller, older brother.
It's actually pretty, it's pretty accurate.
Yeah.
Yeah. So because these happened during school vacation week and three teens who didn't know each other all that well, and hadn't contaminated each other's stories by talking or, you know, showing pictures or what have you, people were like, these are genuine. Like, this is the real deal. This can't be a lie. Not three people who don't know each other and haven't spoken to each other would not just make all of this stuff up on the fly. Right.
Right.
So additionally, the sightings were all within a mile and a half of each other. So proximity, pretty justifiable. They were all in the same area when it happened. One of them was the exact same night, a couple hours apart. And while the other one was 24 hours apart, that kind of gives way to its own kind of justification. Like, hey, even a day later, someone's talking about this and had no no affiliation with the other ones. Now, there is a skeptic, of course, because who wouldn't be a little bit?
It's me.
It's Claire. It's actually Joe Nickel, who believed that the creature was actually a snowy owl based on the sides and plumage, which would have reflected in the yellow headlights of older cars as the peach color described by Bartlett. To me, I'm like, what the heck? No way. They said this thing was hairless.
Yeah.
It doesn't then assume that you have feathers instead. Yeah.
Do you
it
know
had no wings?
I'm really in the camp of like, it's probably somebody who had like a really illegal animal and
could
it
be.
Like got out or something.
Could be. In addition, they said the long spindly arms and fingers that were described could be partially opened wings splaying feathers, which I also do not buy at all.
Absolutely not.
Police told the Associated Press that creatures reported by the teenagers, quote, were probably nothing more than a school vacation hoax. Again, I don't know that. It's weird. There's also another skeptic, Ben Radford, who suggested that the sighting was influenced by pop culture of the time, because in 1977, it was a year for big-headed client-type creatures, so aliens and things of that nature. And some have suggested that the three teens saw nothing more than a common animal suffering from mange, or a dog, or a fox, which again doesn't really explain the shape of the head compared to the body, as well as the fingers and
Right.
the hairlessness. I
The
mean, the
only
mange,
thing,
yes, but
well, the only thing I could think of is maybe it was like up against like a weird background, so it made it look like
True.
it had more limbs than like what it was. I don't know.
True. True. No, that's fair. It has officially been dubbed the Dover Demon either way, and it has remained a subject of interest for cryptozoologists, which we learned in Nessie that are a thing. And the cryptozoologist, specifically Lauren Coleman, was the initial investigator and the individual who ended up naming the creature the Dover Demon. It was disseminated by the press, and the name stuck, of course, and Coleman quickly assembled and brought it into the inquiry with three other investigators: Joseph Nieman, Ed Fogg, and Walter Webb. All were well-known ufological researchers, so UFOs, in Eastern Massachusetts, with Webb being the assistant director of the Hayden Planetarium at Boston Science Museum. Coleman did not feel he was necessarily dealing with a ufological phenomenon, but he wanted seasoned investigators with good interviewing skills to do a comprehensive examination of the eyewitnesses and, of course, their families, in addition to the law enforcement, educational community, whatever. So
Sure.
they really dug into this and really tried to identify what it could possibly be, if they had anything that was potentially related to it already in their records, even if it wasn't necessarily in Massachusetts that it was originally found. Allegedly, the Dover Demon had never been sighted since it was, apparently not written down anywhere. But there is actually another creature that they found generally that kind of fits what was described and drawn. It's called the Managishi from Cree folklore, which is an indigenous people who spoke Algonquin and live in Canada. And also another creature that is similarly described is the Mimigwesi of the Ojibwa.
That sounds right.
Thank you. Anishinaabe people, they lived in the Great Lakes region and throughout the subarctic of Canada. So both of those creatures were described as semi-humanoid, which is kind of what the picture looks like,
Yep.
being sexdactylous humans with very thin and lanky arms and legs. So it had really long fingers. There were six of them, but it walked on all fours, and big heads minus a nose. According to one Cree schema of the mythology, there are two humanoid races, one being the familiar human species and the other being, quote, the little people, i.e., the Managishi. These people are said to live between rocks in the rapids, and one of their biggest delights, a completely non-heroic form of trickster behavior, is to crawl out of the rocks and capsize canoes, and watch people spin through the rapids and spin to their death. So they're rude.
Cute. Love that for them.
So, given that these creatures may span thousands of years through indigenous folklore, it is thought to be kind of interesting that they might be related, but also it brings us to the potential of other cryptids that are in kind of the North American areas and may have been sighted. And in fact, that's what we're going to talk about in our second half of the pod.
Yay.
Man, I'm glad this podcast is halfway over.
Me too. I'm not sure I'm even going to make it through the second half at this rate.
It's a good thing they call this mediocre content. That way the public knows what they're signing up for before they even start listening.
I feel like the listener deserves a more direct warning about the true mediocrity of this podcast.
Agree. Let's send them into the second half with a real disclaimer.
Mediocre content is far more mediocre than you think. If you think that's what's good for you, you listen at your own risk and moderation. We, the husbands of the mediocre content podcast hosts, do not recommend you listen to our wives week after week and instead suggest small regular doses of their mediocrity at any given time. We should know. We live with them. All mediocre content podcast listening is at your own risk. Good luck.
Welcome back, everyone. Blair's stuffing her face, and we're going to stuff our face with more spooky stove.
I need to eat breakfast, okay? It's the most important meal of the day.
Serving it up Gary's way. Ooh. Sorry, that was an intrusive inside thought that made its way outside. Sorry. I mean, if you don't do that every time you eat, you're not doing it right.
I forgot about that.
Anyway.
Also, Kirsten called me a yogurt woman. I feel personally attacked, but it's fine.
I did. At least, you know, you're like the good gut bacteria, you know?
Glinda, the good gut bacteria.
It's very positive. It makes your tummy feel good. Okay, well, anyway, as promised, we're going to go through a handful of indigenous folklore specific for North American folklore. And some of these you've probably heard, not necessarily because you know the lore behind it, but because these are sometimes very popular in pop culture, movies, TV shows, you name it. The first one especially, which are called Skinwalkers, which are very popular. They are arguably the most notorious figures specifically for the Southwest Native American lore and are particularly associated with the Navajo. They are said to be witches who have perverted the ancient medical and magical ceremonies of their people, and they have the ability to transform themselves from animals or into animals, sorry, like, you know, coyotes, wolves, bears, big predatory animals. Despite a cultural taboo against discussing skinwalkers with outsiders, these malevolent beings have aroused global fascination, as we just talked about, because they are on TV shows and, of course, TikTok. You can find information on them pretty much anywhere. The Navajo are Native American people of the southwestern U.S. They have more than 399,000 enrolled tribal members as of 2021, and the Navajo Nation is the largest federally recognized tribe in the United States, and also have the largest reservation in the country. So that's skinwalkers.
Why did I think skinwalkers were part of the Appalachian lore?
Oh, I'm sure. Absolutely. So it's just because it's based somewhere doesn't mean they don't potentially exist elsewhere, I think, is the main idea. Because the whole thing is, if you hear your name at night, you don't. If you hear a knock at night, you don't. And
no,
that's Appalachian lore as well. Yes.
Okay. Correct. Just checking. Making sure.
No, you're right.
All right.
And actually, I think we talk about something similar later as well. The Inserat, sorry if I've mispronounced that, the indigenous people of the Arctic region include the Yupik, whose traditional tales contain the Arsenrat, and these are said to be pan-dimensional little folks who create confusion among unwary travelers across the Alaskan tundra, which makes sense. It's a barren, cold, desolate place. So you could, and probably you're going through hypothermia. I'm not going to lie. So there's a lot of different, right? There's a lot of things that can mess with your mind. You're in the mountains, so you might be oxygen deprived, you name it.
Oh my gosh. Quick story about cold temperatures.
Oh yeah.
So when we were younger, my mom was watching a movie that was on TV. And for those of you who don't know, cable was this wonderful thing where like it told you what you needed to be watching. So movies would come on and we would just watch them, even if it started like halfway through.
Sure.
And so my mom was watching this movie called Shackleton, which is about a ship captain who gets like stuck, him and his crew get stuck in like the cold temperatures of the Arctic or something like that. Or Antarctic maybe. Mm-hmm. And he gets so cold, and I'm like 7 when I'm watching this. He gets so cold that they have to let his foot gets frostbite, and they show it, and they have like,
ew,
and they have to like cut off his toes,
ew,
like otherwise it's, the frostbite is going to continue to spread. And so, me, a young girl of 7 years old. Now it only associates that movie with frostbite and toe separation. And that's it.
That's terrible.
I know.
Gross.
I'm sure there's more to that movie, but as far as I'm concerned, that was it.
Hey, that's scarring enough.
I know.
I'm assuming that travelers in this scenario probably also had a similar issue happening. Mm-hmm. Because the Issarat were reputed to be mischievous as well, rather than outright malevolent. And when left alone, they would go about their daily chores, specifically with hunting and fishing. But if they crossed paths, it may inspire them to play tricks on the traveler and generally make you doubt your sense of reality, potentially getting lost and, you know, left deserted in an icy tundra.
Fun.
So great. A little bit on the Yupik. They are a group of the indigenous or aboriginal peoples of western, southwestern, and south central Alaska and the Russian Far East. They are related to the Inuit and the Inupiat. And Yupik people usually include a lot of different areas that I'm going to mispronounce, but basically the Alaskan Peninsula and along the coastal regions of Alaska. It's very fun. Number three on our list is the Nunasis. One of the most obscure Native American legends lurks deep within the lore of the Chumash people of California. Very fun. According to their ancient cosmological framework, humans inhabit the middle world, with the sun and celestial beings inhabiting the upper world and sinister creatures existing in the lower world. This is pretty typical of any kind of religious or, spiritual existence. Among these demon-like entities are the Nunasis, who are grotesque creatures which can rise into the middle world to, of course, spread bad luck, illness, bad fortune. It's not great. Little more is known about them in mainstream culture, and the Chumash are a Native American people of the central and southern coastal regions of California, specifically in portions of what is now Kern, San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara, Ventura, and Los Angeles counties. And they do extend from Morro Bay in the north to Malibu in the south to Mount Pinos in the east. So it's pretty vast.
Can I say something about this?
Mm-hmm. Of course you can.
Particular.
Yeah.
So I was reading Crescent City, which is a series by Sarah J. Maas, who wrote the ACOTAR series, for those who know. And in Crescent City, it's interesting that I don't know where Sarah J. Maas lives, but I want to say it's California. Mm. It's interesting because their like world is like the middle world. And then they speak about this like demon underworld situation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like what they're fighting against in the book, because it's a fantasy book. And yeah.
Sure.
But it's interesting because some of the way that that was described very much makes me think, I mean, it could be related to a lot of different things, because you're right. It's like a very common, like, religious structure, right. But it's just interesting that like that it's very similar.
Yeah.
To that.
It is
the way that
similar.
They describe it in the book. Like there are creatures like coming to get them from the demon world or whatever.
Right. You know?
Very interesting.
I like that. Well, I mean, I don't like that, but I like that.
Yeah,
that's cool. I'm sure the thing is, with all of these things, there are so many like similarities between, you know, cultural ideas of another world and cultural ideas of what are, you know, bad creatures or malevolent creatures, things like that. So it makes perfect sense, really.
Totally.
So the next one is the longest name of them all. So I'm going to go ahead and attempt to say it. But after this, I'm just going to call them the V's because, oh my goodness, they are known as the Voestinahesonos.
That was a really good attempt.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Very good.
Further known as the V's, they are considered the most frightening folkloric creatures because they are cannibal dwarves who have allegedly that's pretty intense. Who have allegedly stalked the people of the Great Plains for centuries.
Mm.
They are known as the V's to the Cheyenne and the Hesi Satihai to the Arapaho, and they are said to be incredibly warlike beings, for obvious reasons, with the ability to move really fast and even turn invisible, which are two things I do not want put together at all.
Agreed. Agreed.
Their ultra aggressive nature has been put down to the fact that they actively want to die and ascend to their version of heaven, apparently. So they just start fights, I guess. Of course, alternatively, it could just be because they're cannibals and they just want that flesh. The good news is, according to some traditions, the creatures are wiped out. They've been gone a long time ago. There was like a war with the Arapaho people and they've become eradicated. So probably not a big deal now, I guess. Can't confirm.
Interesting.
Anyway, the Cheyenne are an indigenous people of the Great Plains. The Cheyenne comprised two Native American tribes. However, the tribes did merge in the early 19th century. And today, the Cheyenne people are actually split into two federally recognized nations. The Southern, who are enrolled in the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes of Oklahoma, sorry. And then the Northern Cheyenne, who are enrolled in the Northern Cheyenne tribe of the Northern Cheyenne Indian Reservation in Montana. Yes. They do actually fall under the Algonquin language family, though. So we did speak about that earlier. They kind of fall under that in terms of their languages and all of those things. So very fun. This got like a history lesson for Native American culture as well.
I was going to say, this is interesting. Yeah.
Next, we have the Gisiawas. According to the tales of Northeastern Woodlands people, so this is probably along the lines of what we talked about earlier with the skinwalkers. Such peoples as the Abenaki and the Penobscot, this was the first American kind of home to the formidable creatures known as the Gisiawas. They resemble a tall, stiff-legged, hairless bear, the beast with an appetite for human flesh, and would certainly make for a terrifying sight if encountered by an unwary adventurer in the wilds. Yes. Which I would say so. Whether or not the legend of this creature was originally inspired by the discovery of prehistoric bones and fossils in the region is a matter of potential debate, apparently. But the Abenaki are indigenous people of the northeastern woodlands of Canada and the United States. They also fall under the Algonquin speaking people, and they are part of the Wabanaki Confederacy. The Penobscot are an indigenous people in North America from the northeastern woodland region, and they are organized as the federally recognized tribe in Maine and as a First Nations band government in the Atlantic provinces in Quebec.
Hmm.
So I would not go against the Gisiawas. That sounds horrifying. But it could be a good indicator of some of the other weird things you see in the forests there. Or you don't see and you just hear.
Yeah.
Our next one sounds very fun. They're called water babies. But they are, in fact, quite dangerous. So don't let water babies fool you. They are traditional of the Benok, Shoshone, and other peoples of the Great Basin. These dangerous entities are spring inhabitants, and of course, lakes as well. And they actually mimic the sound of crying human babies to lure victims to their deaths.
Sure. Yeah.
Which makes a lot of sense, I guess. According to some traditions, the water babies originated as the ghosts of human babies who were killed by their mothers when famine spread through the land, which is awful and horrifying to think about. Alternative tales present them as inhuman cryptids or ethereal spiritual creatures. Either way, please avoid them. If you hear a lake crying, sure, make sure it's not an actual baby, but also maybe don't go in the lake. The Benok tribe was originally Northern Paiute, but they are more culturally affiliated with the Northern Shoshone people. They are in the Great Basin, which is classification of indigenous people. Their traditional lands include Northern Nevada, Southeastern Oregon, Southern Idaho, and Western Wyoming. And today they're enrolled in the federally recognized Shoshone Benok tribes of the Fort Hall Reservation of Idaho, which is located on the Fort Hall Indian Reservation.
Nice.
Yeah. I like the history facts as well. It's very fun. Horned serpents feel more like a reality than a cryptid.
Yeah.
But they're very numerous in Native American folktales in general and very prevalent in the southeastern woodland people of the Muskogee and the Yuchi. Such creatures are described as being brilliantly iridescent, which actually sounds quite pretty, with scales like tiny crystals, larger crystals embedded in their foreheads, and stag-like protrusions in their heads. Unsurprisingly, given their fantastical appearance, the horned serpents are said to possess supernatural powers and are sometimes venerated as godlike beings. So a little less creepy, I guess, unless you don't like horned snakes. The Muskogee, also known as the Mizcoke, Muskogee Creek, or just Creek, they are part of the Muskogee Creek Confederacy, which are the group of related indigenous peoples of the southeastern woodlands in the United States. It kind of makes sense that they're southeastern, I guess, because we do have a lot of snakes in the woods, yeah. To be honest. So this kind of tracks, because we had like copperheads and stuff growing up. So this makes sense to me. Kushtaka. Looming in the lore of Northwest Coast, perhaps, or peoples with the Tlingit, the Kushtaka are said to be shape-shifting beings, often assuming the appearance of animals, which is a common theme, and have a penchant for luring sailors to their death by emitting human-like cries. So, sirens, in a way. In other words, they could also kind of be a cross between a skinwalker and a siren in the folklore. They have similar attributes. Fortunately, there are other folk traditions which present them actually in more benevolent lights and tell instead of the Kushtaka rescuing rather than killing travelers. So that's nice. Like skinwalkers, the Kushtaka have started making appearances in pop culture, including contemporary horror novels, but if you asked me which ones those were, I couldn't tell you. The Tlingit or Lingit are indigenous people of the Pacific Northwest coast of North America and constitute two of the 231 federally recognized tribes of Alaska. Although the majority, about 14,000 people, are Alaskan natives, there is a small minority of about 2,000 who are actually Canadian First Nations. And we have one more, rounding it out. The Naitaka, these are part of the Okanagan Lake in British Columbia, and it actually has its very own Nessie, which is so nice. Topical from last time. It is fondly known as the Ogopogo, and like the Loch Ness Monster, the cryptid has been the subject of numerous alleged sightings and is a mascot of the region, which is super fun. However, what many tourists might not realize is that it has evolved from an earlier legend of the Seelix, Sequapimps, and other Southwest Plateau people. The original incarnation is known as the Naitaka, which generations of European settlers believed to be a malevolent being demanding human sacrifices, which is not great. However, the indigenous people actually regard it as a living embodiment of the lake itself, a benevolent spirit which guards the valley. Mm. It's really nice.
I feel like the European people like kind of over they were being a little dramatic.
Oh, maybe a little bit. The Seelix people, also known as the Okanagan Suknakints, which is a really hard one, or the Okanagan people, are a First Nations and Native American people whose traditional territory spans the Canada-U.S. boundary in Washington State and unceded British Columbia in the Okanagan country region. Anyway. That is all of the cryptids that I have time for today in terms of that lineage. However, as you can see, similar to the Denver Demon, there are a lot of similarities between certain cryptids and folklores across even just the North American, but European settlers that came forward and had their own eyes on this stuff and were just like, that thing's going to kill me. And it might have, but it didn't. And here we are. So. That's all I have for today. Until our next cryptid part. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Kirsten. I feel educated on everything that could possibly haunt me. So that's exciting.
I mean, what more could you really ask for?
So if you guys want to send us your Halloween costumes or your pet's Halloween costumes, feel free to send us an email with any questions, comments, concerns, or episode topic suggestions at mediacontentpodcast@gmail.com. It's such a lot to say. Follow us on Instagram or on TikTok at Mediocre Content Podcast. Just a fun little reminder, we're not on Twitch right now. No. Kirsten's on Twitch, so follow her on
I am on Twitch.
what, shout out your
account. The moose.
She's the moose.
Yeah.
So follow Madam Moose on Twitch, but you can't,
we're figuring it out.
We're figuring it out. Don't forget to rate us 5 stars anywhere you listen to podcasts, and we'll see you next week.
This has been Mediocre Content.
Thanks so much for listening. Cheers.
Cheers.